This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 272 of the show where we talk aviation.
282.
What did I say?
272.
And joining me for this episode is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
For a minute, I thought we were going back in time.
Sometimes I get confused, and partly
it gets worse when you get older, bud. Let me tell you,
it's age, and it's also the fact that I'm recording this episode from the eastern shore of Maryland, away from the home studios. So we have a little mobile recording setup going here. I hope everything works as well as it does.
Are you outside on the shore itself, or
yeah, right in the shore?
Wow, cool.
Yeah, I can throw a rock and hit the water.
So where's David this week, Max?
Well, David Vanderhoof is off this week, so it's just you and me, Rob. In fact, we don't have a guest scheduled for this week, as you know, because our intent has been to devote this episode to a lot of the listener mail and some of the listener recordings that we've received. So we're going to try to catch up with as much of that as we can.
Wow. And so David is not going to be here for that. I hope there's no history or military or anything like that.
Well, when that comes up, we'll defer that for when David's around. We don't want to lose his expertise. We do have an Australia desk report this episode. Steve Fisher is out due to his knee surgery. And so Grant calls on ATC Ben and Jonesy and Kathy Mexted to help out. So we'll see how they made out there. And we have an Across the Pond segment from Peter Johnson, so we'll look forward to that, too. But first, Rob, let's get started with a little bit of the aviation news from the past week. Are you ready?
I am indeed.
Now, we see in the Dallas News that airlines go on a record new jet shopping spree. Now, this isn't so much a current news item. It's just kind of a recap of some of the activity, and the numbers are, man, they're really huge. The article points out that airlines have ordered more than 8,200 new planes from Airbus and the Boeing company in the past 5 years. Also, that production rates have more than doubled in the last decade. Well, why is that? I think there's lots of reasons why. Rob, don't you see some pretty valid reasons in this article?
Oh, I think so. I think the fact that the interest rates are still low. I think the fact, certainly in the U.S. and in other places, everybody has been waiting for the opportunity to get rid of their old airplanes. And yeah, let's face it, when 9/11 happened, it certainly threw the whole industry into a sort of a maelstrom. And I think this kind of shows that at least they're trying to work their way out. And let's be serious, too. The airlines, at least here in the United States, have actually started making money.
That's right. They can afford to buy planes, which they want to do and which they need to do. We see that IATA forecasts a 31% growth in worldwide passengers to 3.9 billion in the next 4 years. That's spectacular growth.
So long as they don't all show up at the airport on the same day
Same time. That would be kind of a problem. Now, a forecast is just that. It's a forecast. And so we'll see how close IATA comes to predicting this growth. And of course, this could always be dashed by another recession or other kind of significant economic activity. But as you mentioned, Rob, the airlines are profitable right now. They're pulling in lots of money from ancillary fees. They've consolidated through bankruptcies, many of them.
What kind of fees are those?
Ancillary fees.
Oh, I thought it was ancillary. I guess that must be the difference between living in Connecticut and living in the Midwest.
Either that or I'm channeling my inner David Vanderhoof.
It could be. Could be. Well, and I think, too, something else we have to be aware of is that unlike past patterns of airliner growth, the majority of the airframes are not coming here to the United States as they did in years past. I mean, we just reported on was it last week or the week before about a huge purchase in the Middle East?
Right, we've seen many of those.
New aircraft, and of course there is the market in Asia, and so a lot, and we're seeing the same thing with business jets. A lot of the aircraft are not destined for the United States, or even sometimes the North American market. Another good one, of course, down South America, it's time for them to catch up. But as we also said, it's time for the U.S. airlines to get rid of their airplanes that are pretty old. I'm hoping maybe that if I go out to Roswell, maybe I could pick up a nice used 757 that we could put at our flying club. Maybe. I don't know. We could just put it out there and sit in it and make airplane noises.
It'd be
that'd
fun.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, that'd be neat. There are a lot of jets parked out in the desert.
A bunch.
And, it's kind of interesting that there's a statistic in this. We talk about the price of oil and how that impacts jet fuel prices. And, of course, airlines looking for more fuel-efficient jets is another driver in this acquisition spree that we've been seeing. And the statistic that's interesting is that the article says that U.S. airlines, this is just U.S. airlines alone, burn 16 billion gallons of jet fuel a year. That's amazing. And they also points out the price increase. It says a decade ago they were paying 84 cents for a gallon, and last year it was more than $3 a gallon. And so last year, I think this was U.S. Airlines spent $50 billion on fuel. So there's a lot of economic incentive to purchase more fuel-efficient planes. And so the old ones, yeah, they go out there in the desert, and some of them just sit. Some of them get cannibalized for spare parts. I mean, that's a great source for spare parts rather than buying new from the OEM or buying on the used parts market. Some of these old airliners out there represent a sort of treasure trove of spare parts. Another interesting thing from the article I thought was I think they said United figures that when they buy a new plane that's more fuel efficient and replace something older, that alone can save up to $2.5 million in fuel prices per plane per year. That's a lot of money.
Well, and especially for United, I mean, they need all the extra cash they can to keep that customer service arm going. I think they have a customer service arm. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, it sounds like I'm picking on United again.
Oh,
I like United, sort of. Anyway,
I actually do like United, but we've talked about that before.
Well, and let's be serious. I mean, any airline. I mean, my favorite has always been Southwest for years. And let's face it, we've got a story coming up a little later. Southwest has certainly had a particularly bad PR month.
Well, in fact, Rob, let's talk about that right now. This comes from Fox News. Southwest Airlines grounds pilots who landed the plane at wrong Missouri airport. And here we go, another airport or another plane landing at the wrong airport. We've seen several of these, and Southwest 737 has done the same, has joined the crowd.
Yeah, and I think what's really scary about this whole thing is that I've listened to some of the commentary today. I was doing some work with a couple of the TV networks as well, and I guess I'm a little dismayed that some of the people in the media seem to say, well, you know, stuff just happens. It's just part of life. And I said, well, I can't say what I wanted to say, which was something about bulls and some other things, but that's my greatest fear, I think, is that we will just simply say that this kind of thing is just going to happen because of the technology and the people and the human interaction, and I think that's baloney.
Yeah, it does sound kind of like something you ought to be able to get right all the time. I know. I guess this flight was scheduled to departed from Chicago's Midway International Airport, right, Rob?
And correct. Was
headed to Branson Airport, but it landed about 7 miles away from there. What is this, Taney County Airport?
Correct. And both of these airports have a similar northwest-southeast runway. It's just that the county's airport is about half the length of the one at Branson. And so the first thing when I heard about this morning is I went into the airport approach plates, or the instrument approach plates, because I wanted to see what kind of airport lighting there was too that may have contributed to the problem. And it's amazing that the runway lights, both airports had runway lights, and the county airport has almost nothing else other than a visual approach slope indicator, a VASI as we call it, the two red bars and the two white bars over on the left-hand side. And Branson has approach lights and runway end identification lights. And, of course, the Southwest jet was being vectored by Springfield Approach Control, which is from nearby Springfield, Missouri, for the visual approach. And all of this stuff got past everybody. And let's not make any mistake here. I mean, this is pilot error. I think it's going to be very, very difficult to look at this any other way, even though the NTSB and the FAA still have their investigation to complete. But when we look at the contributing factors, just as in the issue where the 747 landed at the wrong airport in Wichita in November, that one occurred because the people at McConnell Air Force Base Air Traffic Control weren't paying attention. And on this one last night, they weren't paying attention from Springfield. And, you know, can you explain it? Oh, sure. A Sunday night with one or two airplanes due maybe in a 2 or a 3 or a 4 hour period, and maybe there's one person there in front of the radar, and they're just talking to one airplane. They go, yeah, okay, that's piece of cake. He's got the airport. Let him go have a good time, and he'll make it. And they just don't pay attention. Mm. And unfortunately, those are the kinds of times when accidents really happen, when people get way too complacent. And so here we have another one.
Wow, yeah, and complacency, that's exactly the word that was running through my head, Rob, when you were explaining that. But the pilot and the first officer, or the captain and the first officer, they're in some hot water over this, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're going to be sitting on the ground for quite a while, as are the captain and the first officer from that 747 that landed at Jabara Airport in Wichita in November. I mean, you can explain the logistical end of it and say, well, they did this or they didn't do that or they didn't see this or they forgot to check that. That's the easy part, actually, sometimes is to figure out what they did wrong or that sort of thing. But the consequences to me have to be severe. I don't think the industry is listening. I think we've had enough of these over the last couple of months that show that the technology and the people in the airplanes are just not working together.
Wow. Yeah, this is it's got to improve. Something's got to change. But you mentioned the NTSB is taking a look at this.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And NTSB will have jurisdiction over this, even though the aircraft technically didn't sustain any damage. But these kinds of pilot issues are pretty germane to their mission statement. FAA, of course, will get in there and try and grab their licenses and suspend them for some given period of time and to teach them a lesson. My guess is that there's probably nothing that anybody is going to do to these two pilots that's going to make them feel any worse than they do already.
Oh, I've got to imagine. I mean, what do you say when you finally realize that you've landed at the wrong airport? Yeah, that announcement on the PA system has got to be just so difficult.
Well, I've never landed at the wrong airport. I got close once. We had a situation here in Chicago at our local airport at Palwaukee, which is now Chicago Executive. It has a 1634 runway. And the naval base that has since closed down years ago used to have 1735. And it was not unusual to see fighters lining up for the final approach at our runway, or to have little airplanes lining up for their runway. It happened. And we did have people land at the other place. We had a P-3 land, you know, the big Navy version of the Electra. We had one land on our runway. And of course, we're trying to talk to him, and you could tell the poor guy was just lost. He was just sitting there at the end of the runway with those engines humming, and it happens. But the question is, what do you do to try to prevent it? I mean, certainly you have to take some kind of certificate action, but the main thing is, what do we do? How do we train people to not ignore those cues? And one thing, and I'll shut up here in just a second, I promise, something that came out of the Atlas Air event when they landed at the wrong airport in Wichita in November was that Atlas Air put in a new policy that said, even during a visual approach, which means they're just looking out the window and saying, oh, there's the airport, they must leave the instrument approach in the flight management system box, and they will not deviate from that instrument approach until they hit the final approach fix, which is usually 3, 4, 5 miles from the end of the runway, which means there's almost no chance they could ever be looking at the wrong runway and be over that final approach fix. And if these guys had done that and had the instrument approach in for runway 12 at, I think it would have been 1-4 at Branson, this would have never happened. Obviously, they either didn't have it in or they weren't looking at it.
Wow. All right. Well, our next story, Rob, you found an interesting story about drones. And in sort of magically, guess who just appeared on Skype, making a liar out of me, is David Vanderhoof. Hi, David, you did make it.
Out of guilt, and I know that I should never leave you two alone together on a Skype call.
And now David has decided to drone on.
Hi, folks. Sorry I'm late. Actually, I'm on time. Evidently, they just conspired to start early.
We did. We started early.
Yes, I did. I did make a liar out of Max and Rob. So I'm glad to be here because listener mail is way too important to miss. So,
well, how cool.
I'm here.
Very good. I don't know if you've had a chance to see the show plan, David, and the stories, but our next item, it comes from the Wall Street Journal. This is called Liberate the Drones of Commerce. And this is something that, of course, David and I have been talking about quite a bit on our other show, the UAV Digest. And the article points out that, you know, we see commercial use of small drones outside the U.S., particularly Australia has seen a lot of commercial applications. And there's some others, other countries as well. But the article argues that the FAA ban on commercial use, which is what we're operating under right now, we essentially have a ban. There are some exceptions made. But the article likens it to the early days when commercial use of the internet was prohibited. And they call this overregulation, or they refer to this as overregulation. And in the case of the internet, that according to the article, that let the other countries get ahead of us, and they're fearful that the same thing is happening here with unmanned aerial systems or drones or UAVs. Rob, you identified this article. You located this article. You think they've kind of captured this?
Oh, I think they have, actually. And just for the record, even though it often sounds like I'm an anti-drone, or what would a good word be? A dronophobe. I'm really not. I do think they have an incredibly valuable role in our economies all over the world. all that I care about is that you just keep them out of my path when I'm in an airplane. That's the only thing I care about. And I think what Gordon Krovitz was saying is that if we're going to make progress with these things, that's great. That's a whole piece of the economy that's kind of getting sidetracked right now. But there is probably no worse organization on the face of the earth to put your economic future into than the FAA, at least to me. We haven't even got next gen figured out yet, and we've been at that for a decade. And I believe that Gordon is correct when he says we can't wait that long to come up with a solution for this. And I'm hoping that that this is kind of the, you know, the kick in the butt that they need, although I'm not so sure it is. I mean, at FAA at least.
But Rob?
Yes?
Aren't you dronophobes causing the FAA to be ultra cautious? You can't have it either way.
No, I don't think so. I don't think that just saying, look, we want to make sure that the drones and the fixed-wing airplanes, that they have people in them, shouldn't mix. I don't think that is telling FAA that means 100% of the time the drones cannot ever be anywhere close and we won't accept anything else and there is no other solution. And I don't believe that anything anymore is that black and white. I think there's certainly some gray here, but I don't think, to my knowledge at least, that FAA has any kind of program other than maybe some chatter, some debate going on that is even taking us in the right direction to solving the problem. And I think that's why I really believe in what Gordon had to say here. And that's what we need to have, is we've got to get some people together that understand this stuff and try and help figure out a solution. And I don't think that's happening right now.
I guess, Max, he needs to listen to the last episode of UAV Digest, doesn't he?
Yes.
Because, not to promote the other show, but we had the New York test site, and their job is primarily to develop sense and avoid technology. And that's their goal, and that's what they're diving deeply into right now for larger aircraft, for the larger UAVs. So your wish is being answered under the guidance of the FAA for once, Rob. The tech sites definitely are, now that the gun has gone off, they are diving deep into getting this stuff up and running. So,
Are there guidelines out there? I mean, have you guys seen? I mean, I know they released the names of those six sites a week before last, but I was not able to pull up anything other than sort of generalities about what the various sites were going to be doing. I mean, have you seen sort of a checklist item of, say, the Corpus Christi site is going to do this, and this is how it's going to come together, or is it still
actually
not quite that definite?
Actually, we have. And it was interesting. One of the things that Lauren said, who is the chief counsel for New Air, which is the New York, Massachusetts site, is the day that we recorded, he had just gotten off the phone with the other test sites, and they were in the process of writing the standards for communication, as well as the standards of their acquiring the data and how the data is going to be used by the FAA. So they're well in their way to standardize from all six test sites what needs to be done and how each site is going to integrate with the other five.
Ooh, that's kind of neat. I guess, no, what's the name of this other show you mentioned? that I should listen
the
to?
The UAV Digest.
Go to airplanegeeks.net and you'll be happy to see our other shows, including, you know, Plane Crazy Down Other, The Passenger Experience. There's even links to that website, jetwine.com.
Oh, God, who wants to watch
you can
that?
Find
all
it
those
all.
People do
well,
is complain.
You know, here's how I take a look. Here's how I think of this article. I completely agree that the applications for this technology are giant. That represents billions of dollars and tens of thousands of jobs if that commercial market is developed. So I think the opportunities are there. I agree that other countries are moving along more quickly in terms of allowing commercial applications. And also, as David, you know, just explained, here in the United States, that there is some progress being made. But, you know, it's easy to say, yeah, we'll allow all these applications in this country or that country. And the next thing you know, you've got drones flying all over the place, crashing into each other, crashing into commercial aviation, general aviation. I mean, you just can't let it go without having the safety the safeguards in place that ensure that we don't get into a really bad situation.
Well, sure. And let's be serious. I mean, this article from the Wall Street mentioned Australia. And as we all know, Australia is typically cities around the coast, and there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of square miles of nothingness in the center of the country. Now, I must admit, I didn't see any details about where in Australia they were talking about these UAVs flying. But you know, again, and I think the one thing I'll hear when I listen to UAV number 21 is the size of the drones that we're talking about trying to regulate. Because I just watched a cool video. Well, it's cool because it worked out okay. A guy was in a Cessna 210 down south side of Chicago here a couple of weeks ago, and he took a goose in the windshield. And he just happened to have one of those GoPro in the back, and it captured the thing, and it looked like the cockpit exploded. But they got the thing down in one piece. Well, I mean, what's a goose? I don't know. It's a goose, 10 pounds maybe or something?
Yeah, a little bit more even, yeah.
So how big does a drone have to be in order to be a threat? I don't know. I don't think we figured that out either.
Well, we know that what happened 5 years ago this week with 10-pound gooses going into engines and miracles on Hudson, but I mean, what is it? What is it Pratt Whitney uses? Frozen turkeys, mm-hmm. Max?
Sure.
So will they be throwing frozen drones into the engines, Max? Yeah. To test them?
New test cell regime. Yeah, sure. All right. Well, yeah, this is an interesting article. This and all the others that we talk about are in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com. Take a look. The last thing I'll say on this article is, and we haven't really brought this up, is that, well, besides it being a Wall Street Journal opinion piece, and with the Wall Street Journal, you never know if the link is going to be good and they're going to keep it on the free side of the paywall. But if they do, I think it's worth looking at. I think it kind of devolves into a little bit of a right-wing rant. I think some of the analogies get a little bit carried away, but some of the points are valid, but there's different sides to the issue. And I think what the FAA is trying to do is stay on the safe side and develop these things, you know, more slowly and in a more measured way, and let's learn first and then commercialize and not the other way around. So that's my summary of that piece. All right, well, so let's move right into the Australia desk. As we mentioned, Steve Vischer is, I guess, kind of going under the knife as we speak. Doesn't it sound that way, guys?
Actually, he's been under the knife and has successfully recovered. Now he's on nice medication, and he'll be that way for a couple of days. But yeah, we definitely wish him well.
Better living through chemistry. All right, so in the meantime, and this was actually kind of a bit of a surprise, but Grant McHaren marshaled up the other plain crazy guys and bring us an Australia desk report. So let's go right straight into that.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia news desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, January 12th, 2014.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode number 282. I'm Steve Vischer, and joining me, as always, in the studio is Grant McHaren. G'day, mate.
G'day, mate, but I don't think you're Steve Vischer. I think you're Jonesy.
Well, what about me? I'm Steve Vischer then, eh?
No, you're ATC Ben.
I'm Steve Vischer.
No, you most definitely are not.
Yes, I am.
Kathy Mexted. No, you're Kathy
Mexted. No, I'm not.
So, yes, as you can tell, folks, Steve Vischer is not here with us for the recording of the Australia Desk. He's actually off the night before his big operation. He goes under the surgeon's control tomorrow, where they get to trim up and fix up his knee. And in the meantime, to try and replace Steve, I thought, what better way to do it than to bring in three of the team? So I've got ATC Ben Jones, and Kathy Mexted with me. G'day, gang.
G'day, Grant.
Hi. G'day.
There's only one problem. With Steve not here, we have no idea what to do. How do we do an AusDesk?
We just keep talking.
We've put together a bunch of stories, but, I mean, you know, the first one, what is it? Qantas got downgraded by Moody's? Whoa, that's another one. That's the second downgrade they've had. But, I mean, we haven't really heard too much about Qantas in the last week or so, have we?
Well, no, because it's holidays for normal people.
Well, Alan Joyce has certainly been quiet, but there's been a couple of politicians saying they think the Qantas Sale Act should go.
But Grant, they're flying the cast and crew of the Modern Family to Oz for a recording of an episode.
What's Modern Family?
It's an American TV show.
Has anyone here ever seen it?
Eye candy.
All right, you ever watched it, Kathy?
No.
Ippy?
No, I've watched it.
You've watched it?
I think it's quite a good show, but...
Okay, moving back off American sitcoms into Australian news, and we'll bring in Air New Zealand. An Air New Zealand A320 had an engine failure climbing out of Melbourne, but fortunately it decided not to land on the 700-metre runway out the back of Kathy's house.
That's good, isn't it?
Having walked down your runway, it could have been a quite interesting landing.
Dodging the kangaroos?
Totally. Oh, hey, come on, don't knock the kangaroos.
You get a 320 in there once.
You can do anything with an aircraft once.
Yes, we've got a great photo of Grant with the Steve with the kangaroos on the runway.
Yeah, they apparently had an engine failure. It was about 15 minutes into the flight, so they were well and truly past Kathy's place. And, yeah, had to turn around and come back to Melbourne, declared emergency. And I believe Air New Zealand's still trying to figure out what it was. Ippy, have you heard anything about it?
No, I've had a few days off, so I don't know anything about this one. Although the article does mention that the engineers do know that it wasn't a fuel leak. They're still looking into the rest of it, though. Of course, the media tried to say that it was a full-on landing, but that was just a reference to a Twitter comment. I do like the one comment that the New Zealand comedians that were on the flight actually came out and said, well, the pilot didn't say anything until we landed and then apologised for not explaining the emergency because he was busy. Fair call.
Boeing 787-9 test aircraft are leaving New Zealand, going to Alice Springs, but apparently it's not hot enough. 48 degrees, not enough for them, apparently.
How hot do they need it to be?
I believe they were wanting over 50 degrees. Guys, do you have any info on this one?
I have a friend who works in the Alice Tower, and I'd offered him $20 if he could get it to delaminate.
It's got to be pretty dang hot for the dang thing to delaminate, doesn't it?
Yeah, that would be temperatures that are not naturally available.
What they're actually looking for is they're going to do hot soak tests where the aircraft's environmental control system tries to cool the aircraft both on the ground and in flight after prolonged periods sitting on the ground in temperatures above 38 degrees Celsius. I believe they'll still be getting above that, but it's probably still not quite where they're really hoping, which was, you know, Death Valley kind of material. What do you reckon?
I was going to say, I don't think it'd be 58 in Death Valley anytime soon, judging by what's been happening in the US.
Now's not the time, but maybe later in the year it's the normal Death Valley temperatures. Right now,
considering
it's freezing valley.
I did see a photo of Rob Mark's snowblower that was about 3 feet under the snow.
Yeah, well, he likes a good challenge, doesn't he? Speaking of challenges, 77 Squadron readying to take our classic Hornets. Yes, that's classic. That's what we call them here in Australia, not legacy. Legacy is reserved for United Airlines and Antique Computer Systems. The RAF 77 Squadron Classic Hornets and the 2 Squadron Wedgetail are getting ready to go to Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada for Exercise Red Flag 14-1.
Yeah, they've been very busy boys, actually, working up just north of the airspace that I have, Williamtown West restricted areas, and they've been active day, night, all sorts of conditions, so they've been practicing hard, and we'll go over to Nevada and bring it to our American friends as always.
Punching above our weight once again, you think?
We don't have a fifth generation fighter to play with, let's put it that way.
Yeah, it should be a great deployment for the 250 RAF personnel, which are deploying with 77 Squadron for the 8 Classic Hornets.
So okay, they've got 30 personnel per aircraft, roughly.
Well, yeah, but that's not a direct ratio because there's about 12 people on the back of the 737.
There's going to be probably a couple of crews for the AWACS and a few crews for the aircraft and all the support guys and admin and PR and media and so on. It's let's face it, all four of us would really like to be going on that trip, wouldn't we?
Oh, most definitely.
I wouldn't say no.
Speaking of saying no, a number of contenders got told no when it looks like Boeing and Tullis were selected for the Air 9000 Phase 7. That's the helicopter aircrew training system, where Boeing Defence Australia have put forward the Eurocopter EC-135 as the helicopter platform and taken it away from Australian Aerospace, the ones who delivered the Tiger and the MRH-90, you know, those other two Eurocopter aircraft that we have.
Yeah, Grant, what I find interesting about it is they're introducing a new aircraft to cover the training for four other aircraft. Is that sort of not counterproductive when they're trying to reduce the amount of different platforms they got in the ADF?
Yeah, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But apparently it's the right platform for the task of taking students who have already done their basic training with... I'm pretty sure that the helicopter training works similarly to the fixed wing, where a commercial third party does the basic training and then they go on to do the advanced training with a twin turbine and so on. I guess it seemed to be the best platform of choice for doing the training. I mean, you wouldn't really want to do the training in an MRH-90 or a Romeo or a Chinook. So you want to get them worked up, ready to go from a basic helicopter into these multi-turbine glass cockpit aircraft.
Oh, I wouldn't really call the Eurocopter 135 a basic helicopter. But hey, if I was in that situation, I'd be happy flying it.
It's not basic at all, but it is a good transition from basic to advanced, I guess.
And one would have to think, would this then result in the end of the Bell 429s, considering the EC-135 is a very popular EMS helicopter anyway?
I would suspect so. The Powers and the Bell 429s were sort of an interim stopgap helicopter that they put in to keep everyone going and keep the aircrew up to speed before they completed Air 9000 Phase 7. Well, folks, I guess that pretty much wraps it up for this AusDesk. Thanks very much for listening. We'll pass you back to the Airplane Geeks. But for now, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Steve Vischer.
Well, it sounds like we're all Steve Vischer, so I think we'd better go away and try and figure ourselves out. And hopefully the real Steve will be back next week, and we can get back into having a normal Australia desk. Thanks, folks. Have a great time. And meanwhile, hey, Ben, can you fire up the barbie? I think we need to get some kangaroo cooking.
What's that, Skip? You taste great marinated.
With a bit of eucalyptus across the top.
Hey. Those guys are very strange.
But great job. He did a fantastic job.
And did you notice that the work that they did on Steve, it did raise his voice
it
quite a bit.
It did seem to have that effect, didn't it?
He sounded very,
a little high-pitched.
A little high-pitched. And those of us that know Steve pretty well know that, he's kind of, not exactly a feminine kind of guy. In fact, he's probably one of those guys, if you haven't met Steve Vischer, he could probably pick one of us up with one hand just around our neck. But of course, I've since moved, Steve, so you're going to have to come and find me.
Who's taller, Steve or David?
David. You mean our David?
Yeah, our David.
Oh, David's taller than Steve, I think, aren't you, Dave?
I'm taller than everybody.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, that's why his glasses are always fogged up, because he's closer to the solar vortex. Or polar vortex. Whatever the same hell it was we had. Solar vortex, polar vortex. I think the polar vortex we had out here on the weather was like the quantum singularity they used to have on Star Trek, but that's another story.
I wonder how tall Peter Johnson is. Any ideas? I don't think he's ever said.
Peter? All right. How tall are you? Not answering.
Well, let's listen to Peter Johnson's Across the Pond. He talks with the director and pilot at the AN2 Club. This is a really interesting looking aircraft. Here's Peter, Across the Pond.
Today, we welcome back Bill Leary, pilot and director of UK-based Antonov II, Big Bird. Bill, welcome back Across the Pond.
It's really great to meet up with you again. It's been, a year or two since we last had a conversation like this?
Oh, I think a little bit longer. I think it's 2 or 3 years. In fact, I think you were one of my very first field-based guests. So it's nice to get back in touch. We spoke a little while ago about Big Bird. We've talked a lot about the Antonov II on the show recently. Where is she now and what she's been up to?
Well, it's been quite a sad year for us in 2013. I think the big recession hit. We didn't get any air show bookings. We didn't get any work for it at all. So we decided to take the year out, regroup, which is what we're doing. We're in the process now of creating a new website, and we've actually got a couple of bookings coming already. So maybe this year it will be in the air again.
Yeah, and as I say, it's a couple of years since we last spoke, and I think when we talked then, you told me about the annual inspection and servicing regime she had to go through. Has she been back to the continent for any of that?
Yes, in the end of 2012, we brought it back from Hungary. We've had all the flying surfaces recovered and repainted.
Because, of course, for those who don't know, she is, or certainly was, registered in Hungary, wasn't she?
Yep, she still is.
Okay. And why is that, Bill?
It's just that it's Hungarian registered. They're part of the ARSA setup. You'll never get on an English register. The CAA would never entertain it.
So right, okay.
It's easier, quicker, and a lot more effective to get on Hungarian register.
And can you remind us just a little bit about what she's like to fly and her performance? Because we've heard lots of stories about the Antonov 2s and their performance, but they certainly are mighty aircraft, resilient and hard-wearing. What's it like to fly?
Very interesting, really. In lots of ways, it's just like flying a big Cub. In other ways, it's a mighty big aircraft.
Yeah.
Very easy in, it's very light in the pitch, but in the roll and the yaw, boy, do you know you're moving something.
And what is her size? How big is she?
Well, it's length-wise, it's just under 42 feet.
Right.
Wingspan tip to tip is 60 feet.
Wow.
And it stands 13 feet high with the tail down.
And, of course, she is a biplane as well. What sort of effect does that have in terms of her stability in the air?
Well, it makes it very, very difficult to actually move it into the in the roll position.
Yeah.
Because no hydraulics on board. You have to do everything manually. And the other thing you have to do, you have to remember to use your feet to get when you're turning. So you lead with rudder. You put the aircraft into a turn.
Yeah.
Once you've established in the turn, you then have to literally counteract it with the opposite rudder and a little bit aileron. And, of course, you then have to gauge when you want to straighten out.
Yeah.
You then have to apply full rudder and full aileron maybe 5 minutes before you finish the turn. So it will gives it time to think about it and then actually, you know, do the turn. You're always trying to anticipate ahead of the aeroplane. When
right.
you're actually, when we're doing the display, when we're doing this display where we're showing it off, we're doing all these maneuvers at about 100 feet.
Yeah.
So sometimes it takes two of us in the cockpit just to actually move the thing around the sky, putting on the controls. Makes it hard work, but great fun.
And traditionally, she would haul everything from cargo to passengers. And there are still lots of airframes around the world. What's the history of Big Bird?
Yeah, well, it's actually one of the very newest ones. It was built in 1985.
85? Wow.
1985 for a private owner.
Yeah.
And it was the Czechoslovakian registry. And then when the two split, James Brack bought it and put it onto the Hungarian register. And it's only done about 700 hours in its life, which for an AN2 is a remarkably little amount of flying.
And she certainly is a good looking lady, and last year, keeping track of what she's been doing close to my heart, I saw some absolutely fantastic air-to-air shots of her. I think it was with Lauren in the pits. What was that like to do?
That was really interesting. That was done at the fact in 2012.
Oh, was it? Okay.
About October time. Was done for photo shoot and articles, and the articles never got published, but we had to hang on to the photographs until they gave us the okay to use them.
Yeah.
That was really good fun, because not only did we have Lauren and the AN2 formulating, but we also had the camera ship.
Yeah.
We had to sort of negotiate and set up and position three aircraft to get the shots as against two aircraft.
Yeah.
So yes, it was a highly entertaining 25 minutes flying. And as you can see, the difference between the two biplanes is just stunning.
Yes, it is. It is in terms of size, and you can just see Lauren as she shoots by. It's a great set of pictures. Is Big Bird still based at Popham?
Yes, she's still at Popham.
Yeah.
Throughout 2013, we've been going down there once every 6-8 weeks with a group of enthusiasts and the AN2 crew, and we've been starting it up and running her just to make sure that all is well with the engine and just doing general maintenance bits and pieces.
Yeah.
But there are plans afoot to have it re-surveyed in April this year, subject obviously to, you know, the likelihood of any work coming in.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that it's been a quiet time. Of course, Big Bird relies an awful lot on donations and the good work of volunteers to keep her going.
Yes, that's right. One of the things we're looking to do on the new website is enable people to actually donate if they wish online.
Right.
So we're looking into that so that when we launch the new website, hopefully around about March time, that people, if they want to donate online, they can do.
She is available for work as well, isn't she?
Yeah, we've done many things with her in the past. We've done, obviously, parachuting work. We've done survey work with it. We've done film work. It's been used in several films. And, you know, we also do a lot of flying with PPL pilots. The one thing which is quite unique about this, as I think I mentioned before, is the fact that it's the largest thing you can fly on a standard PPL. As you know, the weight limit for a standard PPL is 5,700 kilograms, single engine piston, and the AM2 comes in at 5,500 kilograms, single engine piston.
So if we wanted to get that message out to anyone who may be interested in taking that challenge on, maybe a PPL holder or somebody who's looking to maybe hire the aircraft for an event or a show, how can they find out about you online?
Well, the simplest and easiest thing to do is to go to www.an2club.info. And on that site, you will find every piece of information that you need about any AN2, including my contact details and Graham's contact details, as he's the events manager for the AN2 club.
Well, we certainly hope that Big Bird has a more active season this year. Bill, thanks very much for coming back on the show, and good luck with getting her through her next C of A.
Thanks very much, and keep an eye out for us. Hopefully we'll be back in the air this year.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks very much.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, but that's one nice-looking biplane. Big biplane, wow.
Slow biplane.
Yeah, that's the thing I always thought was interesting. Well, you know what? It's just a big thing. It's a big box, and it has wires and big motors, and it's supposed to be cool. I don't think it was ever designed to be, you know, like efficient, was it?
Well, it was. They were still producing them up until recently, but one of the best things I like watching AN2s do is. Most people who've gone to air shows have seen the aerobats race the cars and the dragsters and such. I once saw an AN2 race a Olympic cyclist and lose.
I guess it is slow.
I mean, it literally, in a good headwind, it can hover. For,
oh, yeah.
AN2s are pretty cool airplanes.
Yeah, I like it. Peter sent along a nice photo, and we'll put that in the show notes.
Have you ever seen one up close, David? I mean, you know, like
besides
right there?
The one that I watched race the bicyclist?
Well, I didn't know how close to it you really got. In fact,
I've been up close to them. I think the one year I was at Oshkosh, there was one on the flight line. They're big and bulky and have a very large radial on the front of it and are generally cool.
All right, well, let's move on and listen to a couple of short listener recordings. The first one we have for you is from Micah, our main man, and this is on airline fees, and he titles this Fudging Airline Fees. So here's Micah.
Hey, geeks. With 280 episodes of the Airplane Geeks podcast under your belts, the shows just keep getting better and better. Listening to the recent discussion of airline fees just made me need to comment about this dilemma one more time. I suppose this is a follow-up to my previous thoughts about low-value versus high-value airlines. After giving the subject considerable thought, I believe I may have come up with three ways to deal with airline fees. The first and most difficult to implement is the least likely to happen. The second actually could occur and become a valuable tool for consumers and might also become an interesting business concept. And the third, the simplest, is generally what I do when I need to fly, but could very easily be done by any commercial flyer. The first, Airline fees could simply be eliminated by Congress through tax laws. The law would need to tax all airline add-on fees at double the rate of actual fares. If I remember correctly, add-on fees are currently tax-free. Part of this law would need to require that these new taxes not be passed on to consumers by adding this tax to the fee amount. Although airfares would increase with this plan, fees would be eliminated. Okay, odds are this whole concept is oversimplified, but I bet our old friend Dan could write the law so it would work. The second method is to allow consumers to see the actual costs, not just fares, on the consolidation websites, such as Kayak. How difficult would it be to include checkboxes for services wanted in the search criteria? Instead of just entering dates and airports, also be able to mark boxes for a checked bag, a carry-on, meals or snacks, soft drinks, seat assignments, ad nausea. Ad nausea is probably right when talking about meals and snacks, but that's another story. All those costs could then be calculated as part of the search, and the actual prices would display in the results. This way, consumers would see actual out-of-pocket costs, not just low fares. The third method, and the method that I use most frequently, and with which I have had much success, is two parts, but only the second part is necessary. Part one, simply be aware of airline auxiliary fees and what the charges are by each airline. Part two, and the easiest thing to do, will cost a small fee, but that fee offers so much that it is a small price for the services provided. What's this magic solution? Have Cranky Concierge plan and monitor your flights. Brett Snyder and his team offer amazing service and have always saved me more in airfares and fees than the amount I paid for the services. There is no other service like Cranky Concierge. Yes, many people say, well, I can do that all by myself. And yes, you can do it yourself. But the great thing about Cranky Concierge is you don't have to do it yourself. Now, geeks, you all know me, and you know I would not be writing just to plug someone's website or service. You all know Cranky, too. And I truly think that this is an option that listeners need to be reminded about periodically. In fact, Cranky is a good storyteller and a wealth of airline information. Maybe at some point you can have him back on the podcast as Cranky Concierge as opposed to Cranky Flyer and have him talk a bit about the unique services he offers. Well, those are a few thoughts I have about airline fees, and I hope you find them useful. Have a great night. Hope to hear another podcast soon.
Thanks, Micah. There's a lot of feelings about airline fees. What do you guys think about airline fees in general? Good, bad, indifferent?
Does anybody really like them?
Yeah, I mean,
we're educated and we understand where the airlines are coming from, but I don't think anybody really likes them, especially when you have to pay them.
And I think the other issue is it's very difficult to really know for certain whether you're comparing apples to apples, because people are so price conscious these days. It seems like there are two groups of people, either price conscious or they are frequent flyers of Delta, United, or American, or Southwest, and either tends to put people in different corners. But it's really hard to compare a Southwest flight to a United flight, say out of Chicago, when they're operating out of two different airports at different times, and there are all those things that Micah mentioned before. I mean, the quality of the people and the experience, and what do you value? And I actually kind of like that idea of his, though, the checkbox. Well, I hope Brett was listening to that. So I'm sure that'll be on the next version of Cranky Concierge version 4 or something. Does he have an app yet?
A Cranky app?
Yeah.
I don't know. We should ask him. We should have him back on the show. That's what we should
do. Yeah, I think we should. I'm going to look while we're talking here.
Okay.
But what were you about to say, Max, about you'd want no surprises?
Yeah, I don't begrudge the airlines for charging these kinds of fees. I mean, I prefer if it was all baked into the price myself, but I understand the realities of the marketplace. But I just don't want to be surprised. I don't want to think I'm paying X for a trip and find out it's X plus 20% when I'm already committed. I don't want surprises. I think that I should be able to find out with reasonable ease what the total cost is going to be.
Well, and I think there's more to it, though, than just cost.
if we had the seat pitch guy here these days, we would be able to say, well, not only is this fee slightly more or slightly less, however, did you know that the seat pitch on this airline is so-and-so and this and that? And is that something you value or you don't? And I mean, who wants to get a cheaper seat and then get into the seat and go, oh my God, I can't even move in this thing? And see, those are the parts that are hard to figure out.
No matter how much I pay, unless I pay for first class, no seat on an airplane is comfortable unless it's like the back of a Texan.
Okay. All right. Hey, let's move on. We have a little recording from Evan Hsu, and this is some voice feedback on his first solo story. And he mentions that the discussion we had in episode 277 kind of spurred him on. So let's listen to Evan.
G'day, Airplane Geeks. It's Evan here from Australia. I have some voice feedback for you. This is in response to episode 277 with Aunt Benet, your discussion about first solos. And I thought I'd share my first solo story. It was the 22nd of December 2010. We'd been doing circuits after circuits in the Jabiru J160. Manny, my instructor, had been quiet by this stage, or at least more. We'd had more discussions about operational stuff rather than him telling me things. It was a beautiful summer's day, and we were operating on runway 05 at Ballarat Airfield, which I was excited to use because the prevailing north-south winds meant we hadn't had much time on 05. Manny had been talking down the first solo. It's a bit thermally out there today, he'd say, or sometime in the future. We continued to do circuits and practice emergency procedures when he'd ask me questions out of the blue, like, how many aircraft are in the circuit right now? And who just turned base? What's the call sign of the aircraft that just joined the circuit? I didn't think twice about it until he said, I'm going to show you a new maneuver. It's called a stop and go. I didn't even twig. With that, he took the controls and performed a short field landing. He turned the aircraft around, lined it back up on the piano keys. He made a radio call telling everyone at the CTAF that there'll be a short delay on the runway as the student is about to perform their first solo. With that, he unbuckled his harness, unplugged his headset, and got out, saying, pick me up over there when you're done. Oh, and don't run me over. He shut the door and walked off. I was all alone. There was no time to sit and think about it. There were other people in the circuit. I checked Manny was clear of the runway and opened the throttle. Wow. What an amazing difference a few kilograms of a person makes on these little planes. It took off in no time, and I felt like I was going nearly straight up. I was almost at 500 feet before the end of the runway, and I turned crosswind, made my radio calls in preparation for downwind. It wasn't until after I was established on downwind when I looked over at that empty seat next to me, and it struck me. There really is no one there. I am doing all of this. Up until that point, I'd felt relatively calm, almost feeling kind of like a robot relying on the drills that Manny had taught me. Then my heart began to beat faster as I thought of the landing. But then I told myself that I'd done it many times and it will be no different. I made my radio call for turning base, pulled on the carby heat, reduced the throttle, and added some flap to begin my descent. To my surprise, I had, without thinking, trimmed the aircraft to the 70 knot approach speed and the needle hardly moved. This was wonderful, I thought, as I turned final. The voice of Manny was in my head with the work cycle heard by many Air Force students. Aim point, aspect, airspeed, over and over again. I added the final landing flap and pushed carby heat to cold. Right, I was ready for my first solo landing. There was a little bit of thermal turbulence to deal with on short final, which is expected on 05 as you pass over a highway lined with trees. The lighter aircraft floated a little longer than I was used to. But after touching down on the mains, I gently lowered the nose well. Wow, I'd done it, and nothing was broken. I applied the brakes and turned off at the runway intersection, calling over the radio, Jabiru 4781 is now clear of runway 05. Two others in the circuit replied, congratulations on your first solo. So I quickly thanked them. I stopped to let Manny back in, because he'd only walked a little way by this stage. We taxied back to the hangar, while chatting about what it was like. Adrenaline was still well and truly flowing through my veins when we pushed the plane back in the hangar, but I was on cloud nine. The best part, and Rob might be able to attest to this, is filling in for the first time that 0.1 hours in the command column of my logbook. So there you have it. Thank you, Airplane Geeks, for all of your great work, and I always look forward to the next episode. Thanks again. Bye.
Great story, Evan. Thank you.
Boy, there's nothing like a first solo.
I imagine, yeah. That's just got to put you on top of the world.
Well, it does. In fact, one of our listeners, Dave Pavoni, sent me an email there over the last couple of weeks because he just got his instructor certificate. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
And I was telling him what a great moment that was. And I remembered the first time that I was on the opposite side and I was the instructor letting the student go. And of course, the instructors always sound like they're really, you know, everything's fine. You know, you're okay. You know what you're doing. Just have a good time and come back. But on the inside, the first time I did that, I was scared to death. In fact, I went and hid behind a hangar at our local airport because I told the student or I told myself I didn't want the student to see me because it might make him nervous. And actually, I think it was to keep me from being a nervous wreck in case something didn't go right. But it all did. It all worked. And, it's solo for everybody. So, but it's a great moment when you do it by yourself.
Have you flown a Jabiru?
No, I have not, actually. I've seen them. Saw them down at the Light Sport Aircraft Show down in Sebring, Florida a couple of years ago, but I've never actually flown one.
All right. Okay, moving on. We got an email from our own Peter Johnson, and he forwarded an email from Captain Denny Flanagan with United Airlines. Now, this is concerning a scholarship, and we talked about, if I recall correctly, a year ago, the Captain Jason Dahl Scholarship Fund. You know, Captain Dahl was at the controls of United Airlines Flight 93 on September 11th, and this scholarship has been set up to assist young men and women, financially assist them when they're seeking an aviation career. And in fact, just this past last year, they awarded 17 scholarships, and they're growing year by year. So it's time for the 2014 scholarship fundraising drive, and I think that the prize here is a ride in a JU-52. David, are you familiar with that? The JU-52?
Tantaju. It's a JU-52 is a three-engined German World War II aircraft, the Luftwaffe, or Germany's equivalent to the DC-3. And that would be one on my bucket list, as I look at my JU-52 hanging from the ceiling.
Cool.
So, that's the tri-motor, the definitive German transport in World War II.
Now, there's a piece in the Flyer Talk forum that describes this, and the deadline for entries is coming up really fast. It's January 25th, 2014, of course. So there isn't much time. We'll put a link to the Flyer Talk forum post that describes this, but also you can visit the website of the fund directly, which is dahlfund.org, and that's dahlfund.org. And if you'd like a shortcut for the link to the Flyer Talk post, we set up one, airplanegeeks.com/DAHL14, DAHL14. That'll take you directly to that Flyer Talk post. So encourage you to take a look at that. Okay, in other listener mail, let's see. This kind of goes back a ways. We've had some that have been in the hopper for a period of time. This is from Kevin. We had been kind of corresponding and talking to him about the AWA pilot who was suing the airline for defamation, right? This was the guy that had been, Rob, he's getting some training or some flight sim training or something like that, and wasn't making out so well, and they refused him boarding on the flight home, that sort of thing. That was that story, wasn't it, Rob?
That's the one. And, of course, the pilot was terminated from his job after he supposedly failed a simulator ride. and got a little upset from the stories that, you know, about his job going out the window and headed for the airport. And the one extenuating circumstance of this is that this pilot was also certified by the TSA to carry a weapon on board, a handgun. And I think that it just made the management at the company very nervous that this pilot was headed to the airport and that he was capable of carrying a weapon. Of course, now they didn't know for certain that he had one, and that is certainly true. But the pilot eventually was stopped at the airport, and they found out he didn't have a weapon, and he was very upset that they had ruined his reputation and all that sort of thing. And then that's when the great debate started about should the airline have said anything without knowing whether the pilot had, say, failed any kind of a psychological profile or anything like that, or should they have just let it go? You know, that was really where the both sides of the story came in. I hope I got that right. And they decided to err on the side of calling security at the airport and saying, look, this guy's really upset. He might have a weapon and he's headed for the airport. And, you know, 15 years ago, people would have said, well, you know, who knows? I mean, but these days, nobody wants to err on the side of, oh, well, it's probably nothing. Let's face it, since 9/11, what have we heard? If you see something, say something. And that's what the airline manager did. And, you know, he's bearing the brunt of his efforts right now.
Now, in his email, Kevin points out, or he expresses the sentiment that life as a pilot with the regional airlines is not always a pleasant experience. He talks about frequent harassment and some issues like that. I there's probably different sides to that story. I don't know. Do you have an observation on that, Rob?
Well, I spent a fair amount of my time as a regional pilot, and I'll grant you that was 20 years ago. So some of the issues are different now than they were then. But we were often harassed by airline management just as they are now. And we never could figure out, did they harass us because they needed to or just because they could? And it was probably some of both. There seems to be a natural abrasion between airline management and pilots. It's tough, but in this kind of a situation, again, when you mix a weapon in with someone who is upset, I think it changes the whole equation. And honestly, as much as I know we had some of these discussions on email, if this pilot had not been certified to carry a weapon, none of this would have happened.
Yeah, you think it really kind of centers around the fear it may have escalated because of that.
Well, and again, as we said on email at one point, think about this. If something had happened, and I hate to sound like I'm simply covering my butt, but if something had happened and you were the parent or the relative of someone who was injured or, God forbid, killed in an incident that was related to this kind of a situation, and they found out later that you knew about something like this and you did nothing, that'd be pretty tough to explain as well. If I had to err, I'd rather err on the side of trying to talk my way out of what the airline guy did as opposed to the other side.
Hmm. All right. Okay, good. We heard from a listener in Australia, and let's see, how do you think you pronounce this name? Ariel? It's kind of, there's lots of vowels in there. But
yeah.
He knows.
Ariel.
I like that one. He says, he notes that some recent road trips, he says, allowed me to catch up on many recent episodes of your great podcasts. I particularly enjoyed David's history segment and was also interested in your discussion on Wing Commander Douglas Bader. Now, this is a great story. I love this. He said, did you know that there is another double amputee RAF pilot in World War II, Colin Hoppy Hodgkinson? He said, known as the poor man's Bader. He achieved a couple of kills and wrote an autobiography, Best Foot Forward. Okay, I think that's pretty funny. And then he goes on, terrified of ditching in the English Channel, he filled his tin legs with ping pong or table tennis balls to help him float. On one patrol, he heard a series of loud bangs in his aircraft, so thinking he was being shot at, he took evasive action, much to the bemusement of his fellow pilots in formation with him. He then realized that the bangs were the balls popping in the low-pressure, high altitude that he was flying at. And then, finishing the war as a ferry pilot, he used his hollow legs to smuggle all sorts of commodities into the UK to sell on the black market, and went on to have a successful career in advertising. You wonder where these guys come from, right? He says, while we share the same surname, I do not believe we are related. Unfortunately, quite a character. So I think that's a great story. I like the ping pong balls. And then Jim writes in. Jim says, I want to tell you about my commercial airline travel this past holiday. He said he was flying from SFO to Denver on Southwest and had my usual window seat. Before takeoff, I noticed how San Francisco sent planes down both parallel runways for simultaneous takeoffs. Then on final approach to Denver, I followed another airliner maneuvering right up to our vicinity, lining up with a parallel runway, and then we both landed at the same time. Amazing coincidence to see parallel takeoffs and parallel landings on the same flight. And then he says, regarding parallel takeoffs, I was wondering how safe this is, as it seems to violate adequate lateral separation, especially during takeoff, when there should be room for emergency maneuvering during the first few seconds of the flight under full power. So interesting, and he asks for our thoughts. Interesting question. I remember the first time I was ever involved in a parallel, let's see, it was a landing. And I just might have been at San Francisco, a long time ago it would have been. And not knowing in those days that they actually did that sort of thing. And I remember freaking out, thinking that we were on a collision course, two planes for the same runway. It really had me quite upset. Well, what about the separation issues? Rob, any thoughts on that?
Well, normally they don't allow parallel runway operations unless there is a specific distance. I cannot quote the figure any longer, but and it depends also on whether the simultaneous takeoffs and landings are done in IFR conditions or in good visual weather. They're different. You can run them closer together when they are in visual weather. If I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to remember, I don't think they can run simultaneous ILS approaches at San Francisco. I might be wrong on that. I think I remember the runways were too close together. So what they'll do is they'll stagger them. The turn on by one controller for, say, the right runway might be at 4,000 feet, and the turn on for the left runway by another controller might be at 3,000 feet, and they automatically have separation there in case one of them misses the turn to the final approach, so they don't run into each other. And only when they're finally established on the ILS do they actually start to descend, and then they have sort of built-in separation by how the ILSs were set up. And the only thing that's different is if the runways are too close, they'll stagger them so that the, say, the traffic for the left runway might be at one point and the traffic on the other runway won't be exactly opposite. It may be, 3/4 of a mile or a mile off to the back, to the rear, or to the front, so that they, they're kind of zigzagged. But then there are places, Atlanta, O'Hare, a few others that can run simultaneous ILSs in crummy weather. And that's pretty exciting. But the point about the maneuvering, it is interesting. And but most of the airports that I know of that have these tend to run, one controller's controlling one runway for takeoff, another guy's working the other runway. And they would kind of yell at each other if somebody had a problem. But otherwise, they tend to be somewhat independent of each other. Now, maybe we've got some FAA controllers out there that can correct me in case this has all changed since back in the old days when I was there. But I believe that's still how it works.
And I don't recall any incidents associated with parallel takeoffs or landings.
Not really that I can. I'm trying to think of something, and I'm sure someone's going to say, oh, my gosh, don't you remember? Well, please feel free. Yeah. Call our listener hotline or send us an email and tell us what it was. I just don't remember it off the top of my head.
Yeah, but folks, I got news for you.
the military does it on the same runway all the time.
Yeah, that's true. But those guys really know what they're doing, right? Those are the cream of the crop.
Yeah, but they eventually become airline pilots, supposedly.
Well, that's a good point.
Well, they used to. There's just not many of them anymore. But I swear, when I've watched videos of how the military guys do it, and the guys in the flight are looking at nothing more than maybe the navigation light on the wingtip of their leader, and they can keep themselves upright like that. To me, that is just unbelievable. Just unbelievable.
That's some serious flying.
Serious pilots.
The most amazing thing I ever saw was the Blue Angels at Willow Grove occasionally did a Delta landing, which meant all six ships landed on the same runway at the same time.
Well, now, not serially, right? One after the other? I mean, in a row.
Literally, you know, in formation.
In formation.
5, 6, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Wow.
Yeah, if you watch the old Van Halen video for Dreams, the Delta landings there. Likewise, they used to, and at Nellis, the Thunderbirds used to do an 8-ship or a 10-ship takeoff.
All right, so it can be done.
It can be done.
All right, good. So thanks, Jim, for that. That's a good question. That's interesting question. All right, Rick wrote in. Now you may recall that we mentioned. I think it was in the first episode of the year. When we were talking about these significant events that we might anticipate happening in 2014, and invited you all to kind of submit your ideas. Well, Rick, he took up the challenge, and he sent us a giant list of things that may become important in 2014, and he's got them organized by general aviation, airlines, military, FAA, and it's a long list. In fact, I think I put this list in our Google Plus community, but there's a lot of things here in general aviation, things like will the Shell 100 low-lead research come to fruition? He mentions open airplane. Will they appreciably add to GA flight hours and GA fleet utilization? Some of these have been answered. For example, one of these is, how will Textron acquiring Beechcraft Hawker coupled with Cessna and Lycoming change the GA landscape? That will be interesting. Will the NTSB come up with any recommendations that the FAA will subsequently adopt with respect to general aviation incidents and fatalities? It says, as reported, I think the number of incidents is flat, but actually increasing as a percent given flight hours are down. So there's an interesting collection there. On the airlines, will the NTSB publish their 787 battery fire report, and will that require more changes than those already taken by Boeing?
Yes and no. They will publish it, and whether that means they have to make any more changes is still to be determined. But
it's probably a closed issue.
You
think?
Closed, I'm thinking it's closed. In what sense?
That Boeing has done all they're going to do.
I think it really depends upon whether they find something else out that they did not understand when they, a year ago at this time. And that's what the whole investigation's all about, is to keep digging. And in answer to that question, though, about the Beechcraft and Cessna link up, Textron owns Cessna now. They own Beechcraft, they own Lycoming, they own Bell, Helicopter, and they seem to be doing just fine with all those brands operating independently. And so I'm sure there will be changes at Beechcraft, but will it survive? I'd say now it's certainly going to survive, but who knows how many fewer airplanes they're going to make.
Yeah, and as you say, Textron sort of seems to know how to do this, how to be the good conglomerate.
Yeah, the integrator.
Yeah, yeah. For airlines, he asks, where will Boeing locate its 777X assembly plant? We know that now. Will mobile phone calls be allowed on airliners, right?
That's no, please, open please, no.
Yeah, I think that's been a universal.
No one wants it.
No one wants that one.
We know, but isn't it interesting that we're even having this discussion when we think of the fact that nobody seems to want it? So why in the Sam Hill are the airlines anywhere talking about it? Where are the people
that seem to want this, because everybody, I mean, we could have Mary on for an hour about this alone.
And, sure.
But there's nobody out there that wants it. So then guess what? Go find something else to fix.
If you build it, they will come.
Not on this one.
Yeah, I still think it's worth answering the question, could they be allowed, or is it technically feasible for them to occur on airplanes? And then as a secondary issue, then do you want to allow them? Because, you know, things could change, and it just, I don't know. I guess having a complete picture seems to be...
I have no doubt that it's technologically possible.
Yeah.
I mean, really, if you can get that kind of Wi-Fi in there.
Yeah. So that's an interesting thing. Yeah, I think that's going to be a big story. I don't know. It may be a big story if someone thinks, like you say, Rob, someone that thinks that they want to allow it on an airline, and then that'll raise the hue and cry again, and it'll be in the press. On military, he asks, will the new Scorpion jet be procured by the U.S. military, or will it be primarily an export to U.S. allies? What do you think, David?
That's a tough call. Let's see how well it performs first before we make a decision. But I don't think Textron, we're back to them, are really looking for it as a U.S. market aircraft. I think they want to sell it to potential foreign buyers. But we know that the death knell for a lot of good aircraft like the F-20 was the Air Force didn't buy any, so nobody else did.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We'll see what happens on... That's going to be a fun one to watch. I mean, it looks like a really cool airplane. Would love to see it at Oshkosh this year. And good for them for creating their own little skunk works and having it magically appear. But I don't know. These things never seem to ever come to fruition as military hardware.
Hmm. Yeah, this will be interesting to watch. Yeah. Another military item. Will the F-35 track to its new goals, budget and cost? Or will design changes and production problems require more program changes and/or less airplanes planned for procurement?
Okay. Does anybody ever know of a U.S. government program to ever stay on budget and cost?
But why? Tell me why. Tell me why. I still never understand that. I mean, the feds release a bid for something, right? Or, I mean, a proposal for something. And then someone says, okay, we'll build it for this amount of money. And then what is it over the course of years that causes budgets to get so far out of whack? Does the government change its mind? Does the company say, we didn't bid this very well, and it's going to cost more? Or why doesn't...
Keep going. You're getting a lot of the issues there.
But, you know, I guess that's the part I've never understood is why somebody doesn't say, hey, look, XYZ company, you said you're going to build it for this amount of money. That's what we expected for.
Yeah, but the problem is the Pentagon also changes the rules. And the other thing is when the Pentagon goes out to cut bid, they say we want 1,000 of these. And then they get down to 500. And then they get down to 200. So is that fair to the company who's quoted based on 1,000 production run and now they're quoting 200? Coming from a purchasing standpoint, it's always cheaper to buy 1,000 sheets of paper than it is to buy 200.
And especially when you're inventing new paper for the first time, so you've got all those development costs that you've got to allocate to all those.
But it's not cheaper to buy 1,000 if you only need 250. I mean, so...
But if you're going out to quote for 1,000, you should be obligated to purchase 1,000. We're going out for a quote for 1,000 Rob Marks, but eventually we've decided we only want to buy 200 Rob Marks. That's going to change the cost, correct?
Well, but what happens when everybody decides they want one? And then that would mean they'd be cheaper, right? Because then people would want tens of thousands of them.
I'm confused.
Actually, what I want is I want to be one of those little, what do they call those little bobbleheads?
Yeah.
We could have little robbleheads. Okay, well, anyway.
All right.
Sorry, Max. I took us down a very dark road there.
poor David. You know, see, David, you show up late and, boy, goes right into the tank.
Yeah. Rick also had some FAA items that are interesting. Will Next Gen make any appreciable progress or continue to be hampered by technical, political, and program management shortfalls? Will FAA continue to charge for services a la carte, such as at AirVenture? Also, will the FAA get in front of the UAS debate, unmanned aerial systems, with policies and regulations to manage integration into the national airspace? Or will private industry and technology continue to dictate direction? We've seen some, as we talked earlier in the show, we've seen some activity in that front. And also, will the sleep apnea policy be adopted? I think not.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
I guess the biggest one on that is the fees. Well, the charge for services at AirVenture. I think that's the story to watch this year as far as the FAA goes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of the stories myself, but I think David's right on the money, because as far as we are concerned in this country, we pay a fuel tax that includes money for lots and lots of fees, and no one ever said, oh, by the way, it's kind of like check bags. We forgot to tell you that we're going to start charging extra for that. No. I'm sorry. This is not United Airlines.
All right. So Rick had a number of others in there, and they're all fantastic.
This guy's been thinking.
Yeah, this guy's been thinking. And
he probably doesn't have a real job, does he?
He's from Pennsylvania. How bad can he be?
Well, it depends on what part of Pennsylvania.
Well, okay.
All right. Let's move on, because I don't know what that means. So Craig writes, you guys do a great job, but wanted to pass along a tidbit concerning the FA-18 C&D model being built outside the McDonnell plant in St. Louis. This was the question of, let's see, where did we know? Was it Australia had built, David?
Yes. Grant and Steve nailed me for the fact that the majority of their legacy Hornets were built actually by the Australian, built in Australia. They only had a couple prefabs that were built in St. Louis. Most of the fleet were built in Australia.
So Craig writes and says the Finland aircraft purchase was set up as a foreign build after the first half dozen or so were built stateside. He says, from my time at Flight Ops, I remember the aircraft were partly built at the St. Louis plant and then kitted up and flown by Southern Airways C-130 aircraft to this base, and the remainder assembled by Valmet Industries. He says, we then sent out test pilots to to fly the initial flights, at which point the Finnish Air Force pilots took over the acceptance flights. So the aircraft was not built from scratch in Finland, but pretty much so. So thanks, Craig, for that. And then we heard from Young Lim Fu. Do you guys remember him? He's from Singapore, and he's trying to be an astronaut, and he's made some progress. In fact, there was a news article that featured him on his application for the space program in Singapore. And so it's fantastic. It talks about Fu Young Lim, 30, the project manager, wanted to be a pilot ever since he was a child. Goes on to talk about his aviation experiences and his desire to get into the astronaut program. And so this is fantastic. We thank you for the update, and let us know how that goes. Yeah, we could be the first Airplane Geeks listener in outer space. Unless, Rob, you have any thoughts of getting yourself onto the Spaceship One and Virgin Galactic.
I'm afraid I cannot comment on that rumor at the moment.
What are those going for now? $250,000? $300,000? I lost track.
Yes, but my benefactor will be covering all that.
Okay.
when I meet him.
Oh, I thought you were talking about your wife that makes most of the money in your family.
Ouch. Wow.
Okay.
I'm just guessing. I have no idea. So, yeah, but seriously, keep us informed. We love to hear about how you're progressing and your passion to get yourself into space. That's really cool. Michael sent a link. This is to a Gizmodo article. Afghanistan gets spooky ghost riders as the AC-130H retires. Actually, I guess this is more of a video that describes this. Did you get a chance to see this, David?
Yeah, I suddenly felt really old because AC-130Hs weren't around, in my opinion, that long. But the U-boat, as they like to call it, the AC-130U, is a uprated version of the AC-130 family. Retiring AC-130Hs, it just seems like they just retired the A's and the E's. So I just suddenly feel very, very old. But it's definitely, we're moving along, and the U-boats are now the old veterans, and they seem like they were just showed up yesterday. Rob, is this what it means to feel like you?
No, not even close.
All right, next up. Oh, Dave Pavoni. Rob, you mentioned Dave, the emails that you traded with him.
Yeah, he's mentioning another milestone there, having gotten the chance to solo an open cockpit biplane. I can't even say I did that. That would be really cool, I think.
And that's the Starduster?
Yeah.
The Starduster 2.
Yeah, and Dave said he also got a job as a flight instructor because we were talking earlier that he just got his instructor certificate. So he's working at beautiful Morristown Airport. So if you go to Morristown, check in with Dave and tell him we said hi. He'll give you a signature or something. I don't know.
I should drive over there. That's not that far away.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Nice job, Dave.
Yeah, very good. And we heard from Mark Newton. This is on pilot shortages. Mark says it's pretty straightforward. Prices are set by laws of supply and demand. That includes labor prices, also known as wages. He says as long as wages are so low that you need a second job to work for the regionals, there is no pilot shortage. As long as pilot unions are negotiating settlements that include cuts to benefits, pensions, and salaries, there is no pilot shortage. He says, as long as airlines can keep buying new planes and open up new routes without raising fares to pay for the rare and precious pilots they need to staff them, you don't have a pilot shortage. He says, you know you have a pilot shortage when pilots have job security, when pilots drive cars less than 30 years old, when pilots don't have to travel across the country or around the world to find work, and when airlines get serious about running their own ab initio training programs. I don't see any of that right now, hence no shortage. So I like the way Mark thinks.
Well, Mark and I have come to disagree with each other peacefully on that, although I'm trying to cook something up to maybe make that whole story a little more interesting, because I think Mark does make some really interesting points. And so, Mark, there's an email coming for me, don't worry. But I have to tell you that one that jumps out at me is that when wages are low and pilots need a second job to work for the regionals, there's no pilot shortage. Well, it was kind of like what we were talking about earlier about Southwest and all that. And I don't see any issues, well, not even in the aviation industry, but I don't see issues in life anymore as black and white. A or B, left or right. I think there's always a lot of gray there. I don't think the majors are ever going to have trouble getting pilots. I think the regionals will. And in fact, there are places that are already starting to see that. I think, too, that we're going to see airlines needing to start supporting people in training from early on. I believe that that's something we're going to see because they're going to start running out of pilots. And is it happening? It's starting to. But that's why we'll see if we can get Mark and myself and maybe one other guy together to talk about this. So we'll see.
All right. Good. All right.
Can I go home now?
No, I seriously got to take a break. Do you guys want to do the last one?
We'll just talk amongst ourselves.
Talk about chicken wings. I'll be right back.
Did you see the chicken wings jokes, David?
Yes.
Okay, great. I think that about wraps it up. So
we got one more email from Mike. Hi, geeks. You don't run into aviation-themed cartoons very often, so this caught my eye. The artists even put up some cartoons specifically for use by those fighting to keep their local airport alive. A few others in their archive are pretty good. And actually, we're very familiar with Chicken Wings. Two brothers, Michael and Stefan Strasser, are always at Oshkosh, and they have a series of comic books
called Chicken Wings Comics, and we'll put a link to the show notes. And they're very entertaining and very pilot friendly, and a lot of adventures involving, as I'm paging through my signed copy of Chicken Wings 4, about them going to Alaska to fly bush planes. They do a really nice job, and it's a very good, and I suggest all of you look at chickenwingscomics.com.
I just wish Chicken Wings would make an effort and bring back, I don't know if anybody remembers this, I'm probably too old for this, but there used to be a radio show here in Chicago called Chicken Man. Oh, Max is back anyway. Actually, I like the Chicken Wings guys. I did not have a chance to meet them, though, at Oshkosh, so I'm hoping I will have a chance to do that this year. And so, in fact, Michael and Stefan, I think we need to talk about this right now, actually, so that we can start planning.
Sounds good. That'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. This is episode 282. We want to thank everyone for listening. Also, especially want to thank our contributors, as always, Grant McCarron and the crew, and otherwise Steve Vischer from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. And also Peter Johnson. Find his Aviation Extended podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you. Where can folks find you?
Well, they can find me at jetwine.com. They can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook under, I think it's, David, where am I? Robert P. Mark, I think, on LinkedIn.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And Jetwine on Twitter. But also a big get well shout to Steve Vischer. And we hope he gets his leg back together soon. Because if he doesn't, that means that we're going to have to go to Australia to do his leg for him.
God, and we don't want to do that, do we?
Yeah, I don't think he wants that.
All right. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on the usual Facebook pages and Google Plus pages. And I just found out that I will be representing the Airplane Geeks at our favorite museum, Restoration Social. So I will be going on the 25th to go and witness and interview the restoration teams at the Smithsonian Udvar-Hazy Center. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, congratulations on that. That offer was only extended to a small group of people, I think, right?
Yep. So I think there's going to be like 10 or 15 of us. So I'm looking forward to bringing back some good stuff. And besides, it's really selfish. I've always wanted to play in that part of the museum.
Yeah, that's going to be cool. Very good.
Oh, so this was extended to a small group of people. I'm sorry. See, I thought it was extended to a group of small people. And then I was wondering how David
then
got
I
into
wouldn't
that.
Have made it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, all right.
Just, and Rob
hey,
might have
good
made
for
it,
you, then. David.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter is Max Flight. Also at the UAVDigest.com with David. And at runwaygirlnetwork.com, where I co-host the Passenger Experience podcast, the PAXX podcast with Mary Kirby. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. Again, this is episode 282. You can get there directly with the shortcut airplanegeeks.com/282. Be sure to follow us on all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, Google+, look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com. And tunein.com. If you want to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we have a listener line. You can leave us an audio message. I think Google Voice gives you 3 minutes to leave your message. Aunt Benet can tell us that number.
Please, the Airplane Geeks want to hear from you at 361-GEEKS-01.
Also, thanks to all of you who've left a rating or a review for us on iTunes. We really appreciate that. If you haven't, please consider it. That really helps other people find this podcast. All right, opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening from all over the planet.
Dateline, January 12th, 2014.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 282. I'm Steve Vischer, and as always, joining me in the studio is Grant McCarran. G'day, mate. How are you going?
Yeah, not bad, Steve. This isn't sounding... Are you the real Steve Vischer?
Sure am. How have you been this week?
Mate, you went in for a knee operation. What happened?
I'm not sure. I'm feeling pretty good. The drugs are good.
I think those drugs are pretty damn good. Hey, Kathy.
Just say something that Rob Mark's not going to understand.
Who's Rob
Mark?
Something
along the lines of...
I got put in jail in Brindisi once.
We can throw in a comment. Red Flag provides the ultimate environment which our Air Force personnel can showcase the extraordinary abilities deployed in scenario, unlike the English cricket team.
Oh, dang. We said we wouldn't mention that.
So doesn't that cover if we don't mention the war?
Yeah. Don't mention the cricket, I say, old chap. Okay. God, I've got to edit this. Shit. You bastards. Crickets.
So I did mention, you know, that in the ongoing battle of me and the couch is yet to do me any harm.